Thank you, Nico. Thank you also to the organizers, Adrian and Slava, for the invitation. I was a late addition. This is going to have a lot of overlap with the lectures by Burago and Ivanov and Nico Zallo and Gabriel Paternan. Unfortunately, not with yours. Maybe there is some connection that you can make. These are about inverse problems that arise in many contexts. I'm going to give a general perspective today and go into more details on some specific topics later. Also, the main point of these lectures is really to give some open problems. Maybe some people in the audience will solve them. As Einstein said, imagination is more important than knowledge. It doesn't matter so much the techniques that we have used. You need new techniques to solve these problems, I believe. Maybe some of you will have some ideas. The general type of problems is the following. You have a Riemannian manifold with boundary, and you have a metric. You can think of it as a symmetric positive definite matrix. We want to know how to find the geometry, that means the metric, and the topology of this manifold by just making measurements at the boundary. Of course, there are many inverse problems like that, and I'm going to consider two types of measurements. One is the boundary distance function or the scattering relation. That will be the main topic of this lecture. This corresponds to travel time information. But I'm also going to talk a little bit about the Dirichlet-Neumann map from the Laplace-Beltrami operator associated to this metric G, which is related to Calderon's problem of electrical impedance tomography. In particular, I said there is some connection between these two problems, which are completely different in this problem. So let me start with the travel time tomography. And this is in the case of transmission, where the rays go through. So these arose originally in global seismology. I will motivate the problems first in trying to determine the inner structure of the Earth. For in geophysics, you cannot, we can, at least we don't know yet how to penetrate deeply into the Earth. We have not realized Julius Verne's dream of going a journey through the center of the Earth. Maybe in the future, that will be another science fiction dream realized. So the only way, well, actually there are two ways to have enough strong waves that penetrate deeply. One are earthquakes, and the other are underground nuclear explosions. Underground nuclear explosions, at least we can control, and at least we have been trying to control, but earthquakes we cannot control. So the idea is to ride earthquakes to go deeply into the Earth, so hopefully someday we'll be able to know enough about the inner structure of the Earth to predict earthquakes, which is a big, open, inverse problem. So this was the original motivation. So this is a picture of an earthquake in Mongolia, or 7.1 in the Richter scale. I come from Chile originally that has given a lot of data, unfortunately, for earthquakes. The largest earthquake ever recorded was in Chile in 1960, was 9.5 in the Richter scale. Completely wiped out the south of Chile, changed the geography of the south, and created a huge tsunami that affected Japan, for instance. And a couple of years ago, there was an earthquake 9.0 in the Richter scale, also in the south of Chile. Of course, you have all heard about the earthquake in Japan. It was also 9.0 in the Richter scale, recent earthquake. So unfortunately, we cannot avoid or predict at the moment this, but at least we try to get information from them. And also arises in medical imaging. I call it a human body seismology. in ultrasound transmission tomography. So what you have here is a transmitter of waves and a receiver of sound waves. You send sound waves, it's transmission because you look at the other side. And the sound waves, most of the energy is concentrated along particular curves that will be geodesics or sun metric. I'm going to talk about that later. Not straight lines. And this, like in the case of X-rays, and these curves depend on the sound speed. And by moving the receiver, the transmitter around and the receiver around, and measuring the travel time of the waves going from transmitter to receiver, you would like to recover the sound speed or the index of refraction of the medium. So for instance, in the case of isotropic media, this corresponds to the integral of 1 over C over the curve gamma. So you can see here, since gamma depends on C, this is a highly nonlinear problem. The T depends on nonlinearly on the sound speed C. This is the travel time, also called the time of flight. And this ultrasound transmission tomography has been used in practice in the machine called the Technic scans to detect breast cancer earlier using ultrasound. I hope this works.
Yeah.
I don't know where you can see it. It's the case of, it's not the standard case of reflection. So this here, I don't know if you can see, you put the breast, the woman is lying down, and here is the breast, and there are transmitters and receivers of sound waves. Breast cancer detection, especially at the early stage, is a big problem, and there are many methods being tried out to actually do it with different successes. So let me mention some of the difficulties. These are pictures taken with ultrasound, and ultrasound has very high resolution, but it's very, yeah, so it's very hard to see there, right? But it's very hard to detect contrast between normal tissue and cancerous tissue sometimes. So it has good sensitivity but bad specificity. And so how to deal with this? There is a method being proposed called hybrid method, which one tries to have a superposition of two images, each obtained with a single one. So, for instance, we're always going to use ultrasound in this case. And this is a high resolution method, but optical waves and electromagnetic waves are more sensitive to contrast, for instance, in cancerous tumors. And so photoacoustic imaging uses optical waves and thermoacoustic imaging uses low frequency electromagnetic waves. So you want to detect electrical conductivity, impedance, or diffusion coefficient and absorption coefficient in the case of optical waves. So one tries to combine ultrasound with the electromagnetic imaging, because these are high resolution and these methods are very high contrast, can detect the contrast very well, but they are not high resolution. And this is done through a physical principle called photoacoustic tomography, and this is discovered by Graham Bell in the 19th century, at the end of the 19th century. Before he invented the telephone, he was trying to do wireless communication, even in that time. Of course, he didn't have optical cables, so this was not successful. But he made his observation of the photoacoustic effect. He called it the sound of light, also called lightning and thunder. You put electromagnetic waves, pulses of light, are incident on a sample of matter. They can be absorbed, and the resulting energy will then be radiated as heat. The heat causes sound waves due to the pressure variation in the surrounding medium. And then you can pick up the sound waves by sending electromagnetic waves. That's the photoacoustic effect. So this is a good picture of what is happening. Here you have you put a laser, rapidly varying pulse to the body, heats up, it absorbs, it heats up, produces acoustic waves that are detected outside the medium, and from that you try to recover an image. So you use ultrasound waves produced by an electromagnetic wave to detect, to find the optical properties of the medium or the electrical properties of the medium. Li Hong Wang has been one of the main proponents of this method at Washington University. And you can see here, this is near the skin, very detailed image of the vessels, and unfortunately, in this case, there is melanoma. But very high resolution of the vessels. The vessels are very high conducting, are very highly conducting, so they have very, very high contrast. This is using photoacoustic. The reason I mentioned this method is because it's related to travel time as well, in the following way. The mathematical model of this photoacoustic consists of two steps. So first you solve a wave equation problem. You have a wave equation with sound speed c, solving the whole space. So the n equal to 3 is a relevant dimension, but you can do in any dimension. And you have an initial condition for the absorbed energy, which is called h of x. This is just a coupling constant, initial velocity is 0. So from the boundary measurements of the solution, this is in the picture of the rat here where you measure outside, you try to find the initial condition, the absorbed energy, h. Now you have internal measurements. This is what is better than the Calderon's problem, say, because you get information on the inside of the medium by solving this problem. This wave equation problem, and this is very well posed. And in the second step, in photoacoustic or thermoacoustic, you reconstruct the optical or electrical properties once you know these internal measurements. So there has been a lot of work on this type of problems in recent years. But there is a question, in all of this is assumed that you know the sound speed, but we don't really know it. So the important problem is to be able to recover both the sound speed and h, but we don't know how to do this. So another method to reconstruct the sound speed is to use ultrasound transmission tomography. So you solve first this problem, which is not an ill-posed problem. We see that it has nice estimates. You solve this problem, and then you solve this and this. So you solve in three inverse problems, and they are all well posed, as compared to electrical impedance tomography or optical tomography, which are very ill posed. Okay, so this has a motivation, and another one is in ocean acoustic tomography. I don't know whether this was in the web page at some point of the Woods Hole Oceanography Institution. This is the first experiment to find the sound speed of water. You have a bell here, you ring it, and then you measure the travel time to determine the sound speed. Very simple one. But ocean acoustic tomography is a tool that has been used to study average temperatures over large regions of the ocean, because the temperature depends on many factors, but one of them is the sound speed or the index of refraction. So you measure the travel time between source and receivers, and then you can recover the sound speed, and that gives you an idea of the temperature. So that was transmission tomography. You measure the transmitted wave. How about reflection tomography? In that case, you have scattering points here, and then the rays will reflect. And I will give an example in a moment. Or an obstacle case, you have an obstacle here, and the rays will reflect. Can you recover the properties of the medium or the obstacle, for instance, by measuring travel time information? You measure the travel time of these broken rays. So this is a problem I'm going to consider also in this lecture. So reflection tomography, of course, arises in oil explorations. You send this is a chip with a tail, and you send sound waves, sound explosions, and you measure the reflections and receivers in the tail, and from that you try to recover the sound speed or the index of refraction of this medium. Very important, of course, economic problem. And in medical image, of course, this is a standard method nowadays. In ultrasound, you measure the echo produced by sound waves, and you reconstruct an image. Okay, so now we go more into the mathematics. This was as a motivation. As I explained, the original motivation, as far as I know, was to... I should put this on full screen. The original motivation was to determine the inner structure of the Earth by measuring the travel times of seismic waves. And Hercules, very well-known mathematician, and two geophysicists, Wicker and Surface, a little bit later, in 1905, solve the problem in the spherically symmetric case. So when the sound speed depends only on the radius, you assume that the Earth is spherically symmetric, and they assume this strange condition, which I will come up later, and it's an important one. Which is that there are no regions of low velocity inside. Okay, and the model is, sorry about that. The model is to reconstruct, what they did is find a formula to reconstruct the sound speed from the length of geodesic. So travel time will be, in this case, length of geodesic. Most of the energy propagate along geodesics, concentrated on these rays, associated to the metric C. Interestingly enough, this was like 12 years before the paper of Radon on integrating a function along planes, or in the two-dimensional case, lines. And here, the problem is really to integrating a function along this rays, which are, in some sense, more general than that. In Radon's paper, you look at the translation in Helgason's book, there is an acknowledgement to Herglotz. I don't know what is the connection, but this was much earlier than the Radon, the inversion of the Radon transform. They use the Abel transform to recover this sound speed. Okay, so the metric the remaining metric in that case is just conformal to the Euclidean metric, where the sound speed depends on the radius. More generally, we want to consider the case when the sound speed varies with position, the inhomogeneous case. This is called the isotropic case because the velocity does not depend on direction. And this is the case that was considered here. But the Earth is anisotropic. The sound speed depends on direction. The Earth is formed by a lot of crystals. Crystals are usually anisotropic. And the more a closer model to reality is to consider the anisotropic case. So, in fact, the full Riemannian metric. And so this is a positive definite symmetric matrix. And the velocity in this case is the square root of the inverse of the length of the vector C in the metric G. So G upper ij is the inverse of G. So here you see the velocity is the inverse of the square root of the conformal factor. So this is the model we're going to consider. Even the inner earth, the inner core of the earth has been shown to be anisotropic in recent years, with the north-south or south-north direction is faster than the east-west. So the axis of rotation of the earth gives a faster direction, north-south. And so the inner core of the earth is in fact not only solid, that was a big discovery, but anisotropic. This is the current model, I should say. Okay, so this is a really geometric problem. I don't think geophysics, but it's very simple to state, and it's important to set it up geometrically, so that gives much more insight. So you take a Riemannian manifold with boundary, compact Riemannian manifold with boundary, with metric G, so you want to think about the positive definite symmetric matrix. You take 2 points on the boundary and you take the infimum of the length of all curves joining the 2 points in the boundary. Say, let's say piecewise smooth curves. So this is the distance function, and it's in fact a distance. That's why it's called the distance function. So there will be a lot of exercises in the talk so that you can prove that it's in fact a distance. Satisfies the triangular inequality and so on. And the length of the curve is given in coordinates as the square root of the length of the tangent vector of the curve, sigma. So you're minimizing this function over all these curves. And the inverse problem is very easy to state. So can you recover? So let me leave the inverse problem here. Can we recover a Riemannian metric from sigma? From the boundary distance function. So you're making measurements on the boundary, and you would like to find the metric inside. Okay, as in any inverse problem, there are several issues which are uniqueness, stability, reconstruction, and what's called also characterization of the range. So uniqueness means if you have two metrics that give you the same boundary distance function, are they the same? So this is the basic question that you need to answer before you do anything else. The stability question is, if two metrics are, the two distance functions are close in some sense on the boundary, because the boundary, is it true that the metrics are close? Reconstruction is a little bit not so well defined, but we would like to find a procedure or a formula. Herglos and Wicker and Sophie found a formula to recover G from VG. And reconstruction of the range means you take the map in some domain to VG, and you want to know what functions here can arise as distance function of some matrix. So I'm going to talk a little bit about all these problems. The one, of course, I know we know the least is the last one. But I will tell you something that we know, especially about the related problem of the geodesic X-ray transfer. So the first is, I'm going to talk about uniqueness in a lot of detail. And this is called the boundary rigidity problem. Can we recover the metric G from the boundary resistance function? And a geometer will tell you immediately this is not possible because if you take an isometry, the distance will be the same, which is the identity of the boundary, and then the distance function will be preserved, and then you cannot recover the metric. So in other words, you take a change of variables, a diffeomorphism here, which is the identity at the boundary, leaves the boundary fixed. So you can have a lot of them moving things inside, rotations for instance, or things like that. Then the distance of the pullback metric is the same as the distance of the metric G. In terms of matrices, the pullback is just the matrix composition of the differential, the Jacobian matrix, this is a matrix, and the transform. And you can see this also easily by just looking at the definition. The points X and Y are fixed because the change of variables is the identity of the boundary, so you change your curve by this change of variables, this don't change. You take the length functional here, and if you make a change of variables, you use the chain rule, you will get here the pullback, and then you're going to get the same length, and so therefore the same distance, and so you have this, that the distance function of the pullback is the same as the distance function of G. Of course, this is, as I said, is very clear from the geometric point of view. So you have an infinite dimensional set of metrics that give you exactly the same information. So can you recover up to that obstruction? If you can solve that problem, if this is the only obstruction, this is already information because in a lot of the times in problems that you consider in practice, you know a little bit more about the metric. You know some properties of the metric a priori, and so you can get rid of this change of variables. So to answer that question will be very important. However, the answer is not true. So I ask the question of whether it's the only obstruction to recover the metric from the distance function, and the answer is no. And there are many counterexamples. For instance, you take a point x0 inside the manifold, which is very far from the boundary, so that the distance is bigger than the supremum of the distance between any two points in the boundary. So the metric is very high here. That means the velocity is very small. Remember, there was this condition here that Herglotz and Wicker and Sofris imposed that you didn't want to have regions of low velocity inside. And that's the reason. Then you cannot recover anything is happening here because you are taking the first arrival times of waves. You're taking the infimum of the length of curves joining two points in the boundary. So you cannot recover anything about x0, not the metric, not the topology, nothing here. So you want to avoid this type of situation. And take the example, another example of the hemisphere. I always like to put the South Pole up because I'm from the southern hemisphere. This has not caught up even with my with people from South America like Gabriel here. Because we only have to look at the maps made by people from the north, right? You have to look up. So let's take the South Pole, and here is the equator. So suppose you increase the metric here a little bit, then to go from the points X and Y in the equator, you're not going to go through the South Pole because it takes much more distance to do it, so you're not going to find anything that's happening here. The same here. It's exactly the same phenomenon. But here you have many geodesics going through the South Pole. You can change the metric there. So there is a question of what condition, under what a priori condition can you recover? So Herglock and Wicker and Sophie found this very nice condition, and it's not so clear, I'm going to talk more about that later, what is the right condition in general or in higher dimensions. I say this is one-dimensional problem, really. What is the right condition that we need? And one condition that has been proposed, and I think this we really look want something analog to this. But before I say the condition, let me just mention another interesting case, is that you can find all the people that Skype with me. The fact that the rays avoid certain regions, the regions of low velocity, was used in Second World War to hide submarines, the U.S., from sonar. So this was a very ad hoc method at the time. They used sensors. These submarines had sensors to determine temperature. And temperature was related, as I mentioned before, to the sound speed. So they could, again, it was not a perfect method, but they could detect regions of low velocity.
The higher temperature.
The lower temperature. And so they could, because they had to travel horizontally to see this. I mean, looking for places where the, because, you know, the temperature also lowers as you go down. And so most of the rains will avoid it, and they could hide from sonar. It was very useful. There is a very nice article if you're interested in this, in ocean acoustics, is beyond the sounding out the ocean secret by Victoria Cajal. Again, a lot of imbeciles there, because you know, how do you find again what is happening at the bottom of the ocean? Okay, so we come to the notion of boundary rigidity. So this is in differential geometry. It's a concept in differential geometry, which is, of course, this has been around in geophysics before. So you take another metric that has the same distance function. They are boundary rigid. If there is an exchange of variables, which is the identity of the boundary, so that one metric is the pullback, the metric is the pullback of the other one. And as I have said, you need an a priori condition to be boundary rigid. This is one for the radial case. And the condition that has been proposed, which is not this analog to this one, is the case when the manifold is simple. I'm going to talk about an analog to this later on in the lectures, that I think it should be the right condition in a higher dimension. But what is simplicity? So manifold is called simple if it is very simple. If given 2 points in the boundary, there exists a unique geodesic, minimizing geodesic joining the 2 points, and the boundary is strictly convex. So in, for that case, the boundary, this depends smoothly. So it's simple. On x and y. And there is a unique geodesic joining the 2 points. So for instance, the case of the sphere clearly does not satisfy that condition. And strictly convex means that the second fundamental form is a strict, is positive definite, so given 2 points in the boundary, the geodesic stays inside. The unique geodesic joined in them stays inside. What did I say? No, okay, what is known for if a manifold is simple? So that's a conjecture. So Michel, who proposed this problem in the differential geometry literature, show compact subdomains of Euclidean space or the hyperbolic plane or the open round hemisphere are boundary rigid. Gromov extended Michel's result to show that compact subdomains of any Euclidean space is boundary rigid. So let me mention that result. and actually that was considered by Burago and Ivanov in the first lecture. Suppose E is the Euclidean metric, then this implies that G is the pullback of the Euclidean metric. Let me point out another thing that you can see when a manifold is distant from this condition, when the manifold is simple. The distance function is smooth except at the diagonal, but it's continuous. So you can determine just by looking at the distance function where the manifold is simple or not. So it's a good condition, but I don't think it's the most appropriate one. But we talk about it's not an analytic condition and it's not so easy to check. So Besson, Courtois, and Galois show that compact subdomains of negatively curved symmetric spaces are boundary regions. And all these examples have constant curvature, zero, of course, negative, zero, and here negative curvature. So as far as I know, the first result for the anisotropic case, I mean, there were some results for the isotropic case I will mention later. But the anisotropic case were local type of results. So Stefanov and myself proved that if you have two metrics, so let me make more clear what are the results. So I'm going to talk about some of that. I want to leave that there. I want to talk about some of this in later on in the lecture. So the result, it says that you have two metrics, G0 and G1, close to the Euclidean metric in some CK norm. I'm not going to be specific now about in what norms, and the distance are the same. This implies that the two metrics are isometric. With a diffeomorphism which is identity at the boundary. So this is local result near the Euclidean metric. This was extended by Lazar Sharafuddin and myself. Where we assume that this is arbitrary and G1 is close to the Euclidean metric. And if the distance function is the same, so generalization of the result of Gromov, then this implies that the metrics are isometric. Okay, so the question is, there is something I should add here. How close you are to the Euclidean metric depends on the curvature of G0. G0 is arbitrary. But how close you are to the Euclidean metric depends on the curvature of G0. And Burago and Ivanov got rid of that condition. And this was the subject of their lectures. So this is unconditionally. The neighborhood does not depend on the... You need to be sufficiently close to the Euclidean metric. But how close does not depend on the... in metric G0, then the same result holds. Okay, so these are local results. I'm going to talk about other local results in a minute. So how about global results? So in the two-dimensional case, Otal and Krok prove that if the Gaussian curvature is negative, then they are boundary rigid. So both of them have to be. So these are more semi-global results, what I call them, because there's no condition on G0. The condition here is just how close it has to be in this result. and here there is no condition. Right? Both of them have to be in negative condition. Right? So this is the case of variable, but it's global in that sense. There is no local near a particular metric, that's what I mean. And then with Pesto we prove that any two-dimensional Riemannian manifold wonder which is simple is boundary rigid. So in the two-dimensional case we can solve the problem of recovering a metric from the boundary distance function for simple metrics. And I will explain the ideas behind the proof of this. I'm not going to explain all the details. How about higher dimensions? Well, the higher dimensions is an open problem. As I said, I will give a list of open problems. So let me start with that one. All of the problems I will propose are sort of difficult. Well, we think they are difficult, right? Because maybe we haven't looked at them from the right point of view. So, open problem one. So we need some condition. As I said, simplicity is the one that has been studied the most. Can we do this? So let me talk about a little bit about open problems. I gave a course in Berkeley about Calderon's problem, and I said I gave the students homework, and there were a series of open problems. Of course, I wanted to interest them in the problems. Right? One of them took it up. Was one of the problems was to reduce the regularity for the conductivity in dimension 3 or higher. One of them talked to his advisor, which is Daniel Tataro, and they solved the problem. Well, not completely, but they make a big improvement on the problem. So I hope that some of that will happen here too. Huh? For C1, not Lipschitz. C1 conductivity is isotropic in dimension 3 or higher. The previous result was 3/2. So it was an improvement of 1/2. It's a very nice method. So that's what I want to see happening for this problem. So the result that we know, let me tell you, is generic. Generic means open and dense. So there is a generic set in the product space so that you take two metrics in that set and they are simple, then they are the distance functions are the same, they are isometric. And this set, for instance, if you are in an open set of Euclidean space, includes all the simple and real analytic metrics. So this is a good progress, but it's not everything. And for instance, let me mention that this is another exercise follows directly from a local result. A local result says that you take two metrics which are simple and are close to a metric which is in a generic set of simple metrics, and the distance function is the same, then there is a change of variable, which is the density of the boundary, so one is the pullback of the other. And again, this contains all simple and real analytic metrics. In particular, this implies that if you take two metrics which are close, say, to the hyperbolic metric, to the hyperbolic metric and the distance function are the same, then they are, because hyperbolic metric is real analytic, or but it has to be this one to be simple, and or G1 and G2 are close to the standard metric on the sphere. Of course, as long as the manifold is simple, then they are isometric and things like that. So there are a lot of examples of real analytic metrics, but still it's not the full answer to the problem. So I also want to explain the ideas behind this type of proof, which are is completely different from the two-dimensional case. In the two-dimensional case, you use a lot of the complex structure. And I, so this, as I said before, this, sometimes you know a priori some information about the metric. One example of that is that you can model out the group of diffeomorphisms. This is one of the problems is to construct these diffeomorphisms. But suppose you have a metric which is conformal to a given metric G, and the distance function is the same. Now you don't have the group of diffeomorphisms anymore because you take the pullback of, for instance, isotropic metric. So suppose you take something conformal to the Euclidean, for example, it's not going to be any more conformal to the Euclidean. This changes completely the structure. And you can prove that in that case, the diffeomorphism will have to be the identity. So the question where there is uniqueness in this case, that this implies that beta is equal to 1. And there is a very nice result of Mukhometov, and he started a method of energy inequalities, which led to something called the Pestov identity that Gabriel and Nico talk about, that showed this type of results. And we are also going to use this result. I'm not going to give the proof of this, already has been mentioned, no? Okay. So let me finish. I asked Adrian not to talk for an hour and a half. I'm too old. I admire your energy to talk for one. But let me mention the other problem I will talk about. So one of the problems here with the boundary rigidity, you need to have some a priori conditional. You need to have some a priori conditional. We don't have that usually in real problems. This is not going. This certainly is not satisfied. The Earth is certainly not simple. There are a lot of conjugate points, which are called caustics and things like that in the Earth. So you want to have more general problem that follows not just the minimizing geodesics, but all the geodesics. So this will be the scattering relation. So let me first remind you how to look at geodesics in phase space. This is very useful, very well known. So you have a symmetric positive definite metric. You take the Hamiltonian. It's normalized so that the Hg equal to 0 corresponds to vector C of length 1 with respect to the metric. And again, G inverse is the inverse of the metric G. So now you take the bicharacteristics. You take an initial point, x0, that has a point in the direction, and you consider the integral curves of the Hamiltonian vector field. So this is Hamilton's approach to geodesics. And C0 is a vector of length 1, so you are in the set with Hg is equal to 0. So these curves stay on the surface Hg equal to 0, and the projections the geodesics are just the projections in X space. So this is the way I want to look at geodesics. So I'm going to follow not just the minimizing geodesics, but all the geodesics. So take a point here, and I take directions going in, and I want to follow all of them. The boundary distance function only measures the first arrival times of waves. I want to look at all the times arrival times of waves. Of course, In practice, you cannot do that, but that will be a closer approximation. And so this leads to what's called the scattering relation. So what you do is the following. So let me draw a picture here. You take a point and a direction of the geodesic, you follow it, and until it exits, we have to assume that it exits somewhere. If the geodesic just stays around forever, we don't get any information at the boundary. So this is the point, and this is the direction of exit. So we map the initial point and the initial direction of the geodesic. This is a vector of length 1 in the metric. We follow the geodesic and we map it to the end point and end direction. So this is called a scattering relation. So point and direction and point and direction, and this is in phase space. So it's a very natural object in arises in macrolocal analysis, is the wavefront set of the scattering operator. The singularities of the scattering operator, for the people who know this, are exactly this. And so the question is, can you recover the metric from the scattering relation? So there is an additional information that you can give. So this is, some problems assume just this, some others are the travel time, the length of this geodesic. So I'm going to look a little bit at both problems, when you add the travel time or you don't add the travel time. The conjecture is, if the manifold is non-trapping, then the scattering relation determines the metric up to the natural obstruction. Okay, even some results of Crookes that I thought that he will talk about here have some examples of trapping manifolds where you can try to do this. There is not too much trapping. You need to have enough non-trapping. There are a lot of geodesics that are trapped. There is nothing you can do. But if the set of trapped geodesics is small in some sense, you can also consider the same conjecture. Then the scattering relation determines the metric up to natural obstruction. And in fact, the proof with Pestov makes a connection in two dimensions that I mentioned before. Of boundary rigidity makes a connection between the scattering relation and a completely different object, which is the Dirichlet-Neumann map associated to the metric G, which I'm going to talk about tomorrow. So let me finish by saying that if the manifold is simple, the scattering relation does not give any new information. As you know, it's only one geodesic minimizing geodesic joining two points. You can find from the distance function, the scattering relation, and vice versa. Okay, so open problem 2. I'm going to tell you some results here, but that's really an interesting open problem. And because in particular you need to deal with the problem of conjugate points in the metric, and there are very few techniques to do that. So this is the homework for tomorrow. Suppose MG is non-trapping from a scattering relation, we can determine up to isomic. Okay, so I'll finish with that. Yes.
Are there any known boundary rigidity results for any cases in which a manifold is not
Yes, yes, there are some results. I will mention some of them too. Yeah. Then, for instance, with Stefanos, we have some results when what you need, which is a microlocal condition that the set of geodesics fill out the conormal bundle of the manifold. So for every point and every direction, there is a geodesic going through that point with that Norman, and this set, and there is no conjugate points on this geodesic. But you don't need to know other conjugate points, whether the other geodesics have conjugate points or not.
So, I don't understand,
but I will explain it. Yeah. Sorry? No, no. Yeah, that's another example. Right, that's right. For anisotropic, you mean for anisotropic? Oh, so you're asking the question, more general question. Right. Okay. To any other metric. Okay. Then let me rephrase my answer. No, I don't know. Or any example, any such example. Even in the radial case, let's take radial case and simple. We have a metric who has the same distance function as the radial one. Is it true that it's radial? Is the radial one? That we don't know. A lot of things are not known for this problem. I think that's true, right? Yeah. So for simple, when I mean non-simple manifolds, I have two non-simple manifolds that satisfy some conditions, like I was mentioning. But both of them satisfy the same type of condition. But it's not any arbitrary metric. Yeah, that's a very good question. Yeah. I mean, we know the problem is we know very few examples. Only recently, it was shown that the torus, which has trapping manifolds, trapping geodesics, sorry, trapping some, but have a lot of non-trapping, is lens rigid in the center. Scattering relation determines the metric. That was a result of Krog. He was going to talk about that a couple of weeks ago. But so we know very few examples. I will mention a little bit later, I was going to do this. This is a problem that is of interest in string theory, because you want to recover, from the holograph, the two-dimensional, what is inside. And it's a paper of, I have it here, of Parati and Ravadan, where they have a list of manifolds which are boundary rigid or lens rigid, and one of them was the torus. And I said, how do you know this? There were several that I didn't know that were rigid. How do you know? I said, they have a lot of geodesics. The manifold is filled by geodesics, so therefore it must be true. But there's no proof. Right? So if the geodesics cover the whole manifold, they think that it should be boundary rigid, lens rigid. But of course, there's no proof for anything like that. Only recently, Krog was able to prove the case of the torus. Yeah, so these are very nice geometric problems, very interesting ones, in my opinion, biased opinion. Sure. Yeah, the approach is the same as before, constructing complex geometrical optic solutions. But instead of using weighted spaces like we use with John, L2 delta and so on, they use Burgen spaces to improve on the regularity. So the result is that if the Dirichlet-Neumann map for isotropic case, this is in dimension bigger or equal than 3, if the conductivities are C1, then they are the same. Boas, this is the student. has been in the archive for since the summer, I think. And they also show the same result with small Lipschitz. No, if the Lipschitz is small. Yeah, but the approach is not different. The estimate is the, and these spaces make they are using dispersive equations. They make a difference. Yeah, yeah. No, no, it's not different in that sense, but it's, the use of these spaces is really nice.